Hello, I'm Alec Wilkinson, and this is Sailing Uncovered, and it's a special one for us because it's episode 12, which means we're a year old. Yes, put up the bunting. And it's doubly special because we're in Bermuda for the 35th America's Cup.
Hi, I'm Tom Slingsby, and you're listening to Sailing Uncovered.
So I've been here since the end of May, watching and reporting on the racing and interviewing the sailors for the host broadcast team, who've been bringing you all those amazing pictures of the action on, well, NBC, BBC, Sky New Zealand, whatever channel, and in whichever country you've been following it on. But here's the thing, like you, I've been bombarded by tons and tons of America's Cup stuff on social media, on TV, in the papers and so on, and most of it really great images. So in this episode, we're hoping to give you something a little bit extra to take you on a whirlwind journey through the world that is the America's Cup. Listen to some of the alternative stories and voices of what is a pretty glittering world, I can tell you. So I've set up my microphone in the media centre, overlooking the great sound, and I'm going to see who walks by. We've got America's Cup helm, Paul Cayard, all standing by and ready to be with us. We'll also hear from Ian Percy and journalist Bob Fisher, and we have an idiot's guide to the America's Cup as well. First up, former Olympic sailor and member of the 2003 America's Cup team, GBR Challenge, and general high-class entertainer here in the race village as well. Mark Cavell, you are a very busy boy around here.
Yeah, I love your introduction. I work in the Longtail Lounge, which is the ticketed VIP suite here, which means that the sort of people I am looking after every day really want to be here. They're real sailing enthusiasts. And the day goes very, very quickly because we spend the whole day talking about America's Cup and sailing. And they get to drink Dark and Stormies and Moët Chandon. So.
And you get to talk about your time in America's Cup and your thoughts and do a bit of commentary as well. Very entertaining stuff, as well as your DJing and all sorts of stuff. Fingers in many pies, Mark.
Well, there's here in America's Cup land, there's a lot of parties going on, and I happen to DJ, and so I've been almost DJing as much as I've been working at the Cup.
All right, so what have you made of this America's Cup, in the sense of entertainment and spectacle on the racetrack?
Well, first of all, you have to look out onto the water and see what an incredible place this is to host, these races in the Great Sound. It's a sort of auditorium totally made for this. They seem to fit so well on the Great Sound. Short, sharp racing, with all the amazing super yachts looking on. TV is sensational, the amount of work they've put in to get all those camera angles, all the data. It is a real celebration of America's Cup sailing. I mean, the intensity of the amount of information around is really wonderful, and then to just see them flying by.
So, to our first pearl of wisdom, here's part one of our Idiot's Guide to the America's Cup.
The foils come in two parts, the vertical shaft and the horizontal tip. The lighter the wind, the longer the tip needed to lift the hulls out of the water. Every morning, the teams have to decide which length foil to use. That decision cannot be changed after 9 a.m.
I loved this whole process of choosing foils for the day's conditions. It gave us loads to talk about. Pretty similar, really, to tyre choice in Formula One. Did you find that there was general interest, amongst your audience, Mark, for this sort of thing?
Yeah, very much so. In the early rounds, we found that there were a few weather forecasts, that there was a front coming through during the day. And it was a case of when it was going to come through. And so therefore, if you got the weather wrong, you ended up on the wrong foil, a little bit like the rain coming through too early. And you definitely saw when a team struggled. It has been said, and I think this will be the statement we take away, it's sailing, but not as we know it. And it's a case for the general public to just get our heads round this direction. And as we sit here, we don't know who has won the cup and where it will go and what direction it'll go in. And I think, I'd like to see the general public having an opinion about that and decide whether we want it to go down this road of 20-minute racing and this form. Or do we want to bring more jeopardy in, more sail changes. Gosh, that's a thing of the past. So I think it's a very, very exciting future that we have these choices to make, and let's see how it folds out.
And it's not just on the boats, is it? It's part of the organisation. We're at the forefront of technology, even the umpires.
Every element of this racing has had to catch up and hold on to the shirt tails of how quickly these America's Cup class boats are moving. And we've seen the umpires very much strained at the edges of their capability, of their human eye. You can't get everything back with just using technology. But that is the nature of the sport. It won't be the last difficult time on the water for an umpire, and it wasn't the first.
And that trickles down into grassroots sport, or does it?
I was out with the mark laying group the other day, out on Adam Barbosa's boat, and he was showing me that every single mark boat had an iPad. The race committee put in the coordinates of where they want the marks, and you take your iPad and you drive with your mark on the back until your cross sits over their naught and you drop the mark over the side. And rather than radioing around everyone, this, get it up, move it around, put it down again, it is such an efficient way to run races. And I can see that trickling down. You know, you buy your set of iPads that the club has, and you have that formula that you can work at any club. So there will be all sorts of little trickle-downs that we'll see. I'm not sure if I'm going to go sit on a bike next time I go sailing, but it'd be really exciting to see.
The wing of a current America's Cup boat is 100 square metres. That's bigger than a badminton court.
Well, we keep hearing how revolutionary these brand new America's Cup boats are, and they are indeed. But it's not the first time Bermuda has been at the centre of a sailing revolution. Jay Kemp joins us now from the Royal Bermuda Yacht Club, ex-Olympian in the Tornado class a few years back, and you're really kind of part of the sailing fabric of these islands. Let's talk first about technology. It's a few hundred years ago, but Bermuda was at the centre of a pretty vital bit of inventing as far as sailing is concerned.
Yes, I think that's correct. I mean, back in the 1700s, clearly there were no steamships. Everything was about sailing vessels. If you had the fastest sailing vessel, you could do more deliveries than anybody else. If you had fast sailing vessels, you could send messages, break blockades, whatever. And the Bermudians back in the 1700s learned how to sail a boat upwind more effectively than anyone else. And that's why the rig that we're seeing today on these very fast catamarans is the Bermuda rig that was pioneered by very local people just trying to make a living out of sailing cargo back and forth in Bermuda.
So just talk us through the Bermuda rig, the traditional Bermuda rig. How does it work? What's it look like?
Well, prior to the Bermuda rig being developed to where, as we know it today, there was a gaff rig, and boats generally, that long boats that were sailing around the world would sail with the trade winds. So they would wait for the wind. They would go to areas of the world and sail across the oceans when the winds were behind them. Nobody wanted to sail upwind, because it was slow, you had to tack back and forth, as we know, and your VMG, velocity made good to where you want to go, is poor when you're going upwind. Going downwind, it's a direct shot.
So we're talking about the Cutty Sarks of the world, these big clipper ships.
Yeah, the Cutty Sarks were very fast, very, very efficient vessels for transporting cargo, but they followed the trade winds. They were fantastic. Going downwind, and they set big square sails, and the fastest, if you could get more tea to Britain before the other guy, you made a lot more money than him, because you Brits were waiting for the tea to arrive.
But it needed the Bermudians to develop a rig that worked upwind.
I think that's correct. I mean, everybody was trying to figure that one out, but what happened in Bermuda in the late 1700s, the island is on a northeast-southwest axis, and the prevailing wind is from the southwest, and the capital is in the northeast corner. So all the cargo that arrived in Bermuda had to be cleared on the docks and then transported around the island. And so all these little small sailing freighters would sail the cargo up to Hamilton, which became the capital. So guys were out on the North Shore testing different techniques, how to sail their boats faster and get more journeys in per day or per week. And they would try different things and talk to each other. And this, and the basic way to explain it is, instead of having square sails or boats with gaff rigs, they pulled the gaff up higher and higher and higher until you ended up with a triangular sail. And they learned that they could sail these boats more efficiently and more effectively to windward with triangular sails. They also learned how to set the jibs, which were triangular, whether to set two jibs or another jib aloft, depending on the light air. So there was a lot of experimentation going on.
But surely a triangular sail had been invented before the 1700s?
Not to go to windward to the extent that occurred in Bermuda. There were lateen rigs that were used by the Egyptians on the Nile, but no one had ever really worked this part of it out. So really what you've got is you've got two triangular sails, the jib and the mainsail, and the slot between the two creates a lot more draft, a lot more wind goes between the two sails and creates low pressure on the mainsail and sucks the boat to windward. That's how it works. I mean, that's how airplane wings work. So,
and talking of wings, that brings us full circle, 300 odd years later, to these magnificent America's Cup boats with their huge sails, which are, well, they're more aeroplane wing than sail.
Well, that's right. And they are, because they are going at such high speeds, it is more like an airplane wing. I mean, think of when they first came up with airplanes that were biplanes and triplanes. They had two or three wings to give enough lift to get the plane off the ground. But the faster you go, the more lift you create because you're creating your own apparent wind. So these new boats are just taking the basic principle of how you sail a boat to windward or how you create power to make the boat go forward. It's an extreme version of the old Bermuda rig, which was used to transport cargo from St. George's to Hamilton.
Yeah, it's funny to think of all these racing bases full of designers, and you know we're in the America's Cup Village right now, and looking out across Artemis Racing and Emirates Team New Zealand, and they've got all these extremely intelligent people. They've come up with what is effectively just a slightly more modern version of what Bermudians came up with in the 1700s.
Well, I think that's right. And the other thing that happened in Bermuda back in those days is that there was an abundance of Bermuda cedar on the island, which was the indigenous tree. And it's a very, very strong wood. It's 70% of the weight of oak. So most of the sailing vessels in those days were built of oak, so they were heavy. Bermuda boats were built of Bermuda cedar. They were light. They could go to windward, and they were faster. So Messenger, Admiral Nelson commissioned six or seven Bermuda sloops to be his messenger ships to take messages to and fro. And in fact, there was a Bermuda-built boat called the Pickle that brought the message to the Admiralty in London that Trafalgar was won.
And are there any Bermudan rigs still out there that we can see?
Not the real old-time boats that were, it's just too many years ago, they've all deteriorated. There's one local boat called the Shamrock, which is still sailing. It was built in about 1860, we believe. But perhaps the best example of a boat that is high profile is the Spirit of Bermuda, which is owned by the Bermuda Sloop Foundation, which is a foundation that was set up for Bermuda's youth. And it is a traditional vessel built by Bermudians back in and around, we think, about the 1830s. So it's a replica of the type of vessels that were used by the Bermudian seafarers in those days. And the Bermuda Sloop Foundation vessel, Spirit of Bermuda, is a good example. It's made of all modern materials, so it can last. But the actual sail design, the mast rakes, the way there's loose-footed booms, loose-footed mainsails, and leg of mutton on the mizzen. I mean, there's lots of old traditional things happening there. And it's a really good example. And it is, one of its missions is to is to celebrate Bermuda's maritime heritage in addition to youth development, but also to become an icon for the country. And I think we are fast becoming known for that. And if you're interested, people that might be interested, have a look at www.bermudasloop.org, where all that information is contained.
As a proud Bermudian who's represented his country at the Olympics, how important is this event to you guys? How proud are you?
Well, I think that Bermuda is a very small place. It's only 60,000 people. It's 20 square miles. It's out in the middle of nowhere. It's the second most remote island in the world. It's a dot in the middle of nowhere. And for a place like this, with its sailing legacy of the Bermuda rig and the Bermuda sloops and its incredible maritime heritage, to actually have an opportunity to host this type of event, which is the pinnacle of sailing, the synergies go. There are many other synergies I could link up for you at another time, but it's remarkable. As a Bermudian, we're very proud, and if Bermuda has produced anything for the world, it's not Bermuda shorts, it's not the Bermuda Triangle. Folks, it's the Bermuda rig.
Ben Ainslie names all his boats Rita, who by coincidence is the patron saint of impossible causes, an apt name for his America's Cup boat that proved too slow from day one.
So, Mark, what's your take on the British campaign? You know, after all the talk of bringing the cup home, all that preparation, in the end, they just didn't build a boat that was fast enough.
Well, I'm not part of Land Rover BAR, so I don't know the real answer. But looking from outside in, they did a fantastic job of getting the nation behind, Portsmouth behind, and really building the awareness of the America's Cup, for a start, in the UK. And, you know, you can't tell that story without saying we're going to do our damn best to bring the cup home. Gosh, it's been 166 years, and I think this is the 17th time that Britain has had a go at getting it back. So naturally, that's going to be the aim of the marketing and the media behind it. But then the team has got to do the work and actually to get to win the thing. And I think being back in the UK was good in many respects. It saved a lot of money. But by the time they got out here, they realized that the horse had bolted and the fleet had gone in a slightly different design direction. And it takes 3 months to build foils. And by that time, you're kind of committed into the corner you're in. And I think it was just, you know, basically too late to realize they're off the pace. And with respect to all of them, they did an incredible job getting back up to, you know, raceable pace, and I think they left Bermuda with their heads high, feeling that they had actually improved. They did a lot to get back into it. So we will see a stronger team. This whole experience, I'm sure, has shaped them, and depending on the direction of the America's Cup, we really look forward to Ben Ainslie and the boys bringing that cup home one day.
Well, of course, as it turned out, the British sailor who achieved the most here in Bermuda was Ian Percy, who ran the Swedish team Artemis. He was also their tactician. He helped them make the Challenger final against Team New Zealand. So really was the Brit who got the furthest in this campaign. In the end, the Kiwis were just too strong. Right after that final race, I asked Ian if he'd contemplate teaming up with Ben Ainslie for the next cup.
Me and Ben are really good mates, but we're now mates and competitors. But that doesn't in any way, has never detracted actually, which is great from our friendship. We talked many times through this whole campaign, and in a lot of ways we're faced with the same challenges. But we're at that point now, I think, in both of our careers where, you know, we're leading a team, and the fact that we have a friendship and an ability to chat and talk about those pressures is great. But it would be hard, I think, for me to leave the team I have here at Artemis, the people we have, Torbjörn particularly, frankly. And, you know, myself and him have done every deal we've ever done on a handshake. It's always just been about, my passion for Artemis and what really started 4 or 5 years ago for me and Bart when we left after the Olympics and started with Artemis. So, no, I think, you know, my passion and my heart is with a group of 100 people with an owner who's absolutely very, very special. And, you know, I'm going to enjoy being Ben's friend and his rival.
Ian Percy, always great to interview, always with his heart firmly on his sleeve. Good stuff. There was one success story for Land Rover BAR, by the way, because their academy team won the Youth America's Cup. They literally stole the win from the grasp of the Kiwis in a really dramatic final race. The Kiwis crossed the line. They thought they'd won, but then all sorts of other things went on in the rest of the fleet that basically handed the win to the British team. We've also had a super yacht regatta, and we saw the return of the J boats here in Bermuda. The first time seven J-class boats have lined up on an America's Cup start line since the 1930s. It was just a vision to behold. They are the most stunningly beautiful boats. And on board one of them was Peter Eisler, who won the America's Cup in 1988 with Dennis Conner on Stars and Stripes.
The cool thing about the J-class, they were formed and the class evolved around the America's Cup, and that game hasn't changed. The America's Cup is about technology. It has always been about the fastest boat and coming up with the craft within the rules of the day that wins the race on the course where the course will be. So back in the day, these Jays raced in Newport, Rhode Island, and in medium winds, and you know, we're racing against one boat, the Ranger, which was the first hull to ever have gone through scientific tank testing, where they actually built scale models and measured the forces on the boat. So the Jays were early days for technology, and that string has just proceeded all the way to what we have today on the Great Sound when the 49-foot foilers are out there. When you navigate on the J boat, it takes 15 seconds to go a boat length, between 10 and 15 seconds to go one boat length. And the rules that haven't changed, or that we sail under this essentially the same rules as the AC boats, the foilers, and they're probably going one boat length every half a second. So my job as a navigator of plotting where we are and planning our course relative to the strategy of the wind and the other boats happens much slower. That makes my job a lot different than the navigator or the guy who does many jobs, including navigation on board the foiling boats. So I was around when Ted Turner and Gary Jobson faced off in Newport when two Jays were restored in the late 80s, and I was lucky enough to be Ted's tactician, and I've sailed on a number of the Jays here as the class has grown, and it's really special to see the support or the interest of the individuals who have built these boats and recreated a moment of history. And all the Jays here, maybe except with Shamrock excluded, the owners have spent a lot of money to make them raceable. I mean, although they're beautiful and they weigh 150 tons and have heated towel racks and air conditioning down below, that's what they have to be to qualify to be a J-boat. And they were designed, their hulls were designed in the 20s and 30s. But from the deck up, we have the latest technology, carbon fiber rigs, carbon fiber rigging, carbon fiber sails, just like the highest tech materials, engineering and design as the airfoils that are being used on board the catamarans. And in fact, a lot of the same vendors from the scientists and engineers and designers are working in both areas. So really it's a game of Reynolds numbers. If you know, a J-boat sail goes through the air at a lot slower speed than the wing sail of a catamaran, but it's the same science, and we're playing the same game, trying to squeeze out 0.1% of an advantage.
Yeah, absolutely stunning, those J-class yachts. Mark Cavell still with me, and Mark, I said earlier you had fingers in many pies here, and your experience also meant that you got invited to sail on one of those boats, and they are, well, what's it like?
Well, I think it wasn't necessarily my experience, it was my strength, because what's it like? Everything is a huge lift. Obviously, gone are the days of pulling everything by hand. It's obviously electric winches, but all the sails are still just as big, and it takes a lot of people to move them around the foredeck. And one of my jobs on board was to lift the end of the pole up, it's a lot heavier than it looks. But I was very lucky at the age of 16, 17 to sail on Valsheda before she was done up properly and electrolyzed, I guess. And I remember it taking 25 people to hoist the main up and literally sail it old style. So it was amazing for me to get back on the boat and actually race the boats and see them in their splendor. And of course, the history of seven boats on a line, which is was really quite something.
Well, Paul Kayard is coming over to us, an absolute legend, having competed in, I think it's seven America's Cups, still remains a superstar in Italy for skippering the Italian challenger Il Moro di Venezia in 1992. Paul, welcome to Sailing Uncovered. With so much experience of the Cup, how have you found this one?
Well, it's, you know, the game's changed a lot. The boats are very fast. And I think one of the interesting things is if you look at especially Team New Zealand with Peter Burling and five of the six crew, they're in their first America's Cup. One of the crew members had never sailed a race until the beginning of the qualification series. And in my day, my first cup was 1983 in Newport, Rhode Island. You know, you had to be a veteran of sorts to get behind the main sheet to be a tactician or a helmsman and or a navigator. And I think in the cup 30 years ago, experience really counted a lot. It was a very strategic game. Things happened more slowly. You had time to plan things out, and experience really counted. Nowadays, you're finding the helmsman, Nathan Outridge, is another case in point, who was a first-time America's Cup sailor in 2013, and he was the skipper at 26 years old. That's because these boats are much more high-speed and much more sensitivity and intuition-based than their predecessors. So the game's changed in terms of what we see, the speed, but that requires a completely different athlete.
Where does that leave you as far as your enjoyment of this spectacle is concerned?
Well, it definitely leaves me as a competitor out of the event because I've definitely aged out. And
well, several generations have been aged out because in the past you could have been on board an America's Cup boat in your 60s.
That's correct. Yeah. So several. I mean, you're going to see Dean Barker and even Jimmy Spithill, who are about 40, probably on the bubble as far as being able to be the helmsman next time. And a guy like Burling's got a couple left in him for sure at 26 years old. So, it's a different game. But, you know, life goes that way. I mean, things move on. And, I mean, also 20 years ago, we hardly had the internet. And now people are shopping, you know, buying their groceries. Amazon just bought Whole Foods, and, you know, Amazon's taking over retailing. So, I mean, there won't be stores pretty soon. We'll just get everything online. The world moves forward, so does sport.
As a sailing regatta, are you enjoying it, though?
Yeah, I enjoy it. I appreciate it. The differences don't bother me. They do to people like my father, who's 85 years old. You know, he can't get his head around this new style. He really prefers the old style, but I'm adaptive enough, and I appreciate the fast pace of the boats. I think it's very exciting just to see a machine powered by the wind going three times the wind speed. I mean, technologically, that's very cool. I mean, how do you do that? You know, it makes no sense. How can the boat be going three times the wind speed? But they are, and that has a lot to do with lift and drag and a lot of scientific stuff. So I think it's very compelling. It's a very compelling competition, and I'm enjoying it.
Compelling, enjoyable. What's the one thing you miss that you're sort of reminiscing about, going, oh, in my day, we used to do this?
Well, one thing that I am very happy about, and I often write, when I get asked these questions, you know, I write about both of Whitbread or Volvo Ocean Race and the America's Cup. There still is a lot of technology in the America's Cup, but the Volvo's gone one design, and I really remember enjoying the developmental side of those events. I also remember the Whitbread being really about going in the Southern Ocean, and it was less commercially driven, but I understand why things need to be commercially driven nowadays. So I appreciate and can accept the now, and I'm really happy that I did the events in the time that I did them.
Well, you faced Team New Zealand in 1992. You were 3-1 down, I believe. What sticks in your mind about that challenge?
The Kiwis were the favorite boat going in, and you know, the story that sticks in that out of that series was the bowsprit story, and we had a protest about the Kiwi use of the bowsprit, and we eventually were successful in proving to the jury that they were misusing the bowsprit, and they had to stop the way they were sailing the boat, and that kind of tends to be what everybody remembers about it. But for me, the pivotal moment was we were tied 3-3, and that morning of the seventh race, we go out to the line, and Russell Coutts and Brad Butterworth are now on Team New Zealand, and Rod Davis is off the boat. And I think from a lot of my Italian crew, they were pretty intimidated by, you know, Coutts, and who at that up to that point had been the backup helmsman. But I just flipped it the other way around, and I said to the guys, yeah, he's good and everything. But I said, imagine the turmoil that's been in that camp in the last 12 hours to make that change. And just know that they are very, you know, disrupted and upset over there. So we're not going to have 100% of their best effort. And sure enough, we won the next two races straight and won the Louis Vuitton Cup.
I wonder how many great motivational speeches like that one have been made here in Bermuda over the last month or so. Mark, Paul has always been a huge personality. Do you think we still have personalities like that in the Cup today?
Oh, absolutely. I think you only have to look at the press conferences to see those personalities come out. Jimmy Spittle, absolutely brilliant at the mind games. Ian Percy's personality coming out, you know, his passion as we saw him race and his disappointment of not getting things right out in the water.
Okay, well, we've heard Paul Kayard's thoughts on this America's Cup. I suspect our next guest has a few other ideas. He's actually more experienced of the Cup than even Paul Kayard, except from the other side of it. He's written books and articles and all sorts over the years. Bob Fisher, thanks for coming over to talk to us. So what do you think of what you've witnessed here in Bermuda?
I used to prefer the old America's Cup in monohulls. All right, I've been a catamaran man in my time, but I don't feel that this is America's Cup racing. It just ain't right. But it's what we've got, so we grab it by the nuts and keep going with it, I suppose.
You think we'd go back to monohulls?
Yeah, but a really well thought out monohull that's going to be capable of doing 12, 15 knots upwind and 30 knots down, so why not? It will have other sails other than this wing. And so people will be, it'll push crews into doing something as opposed to putting them on grinders and making them produce the power for the hydraulics.
And you don't think sailing's moved on then?
I think sailing, the Americans.
Let me just rephrase that. Not sailing moved on, but the sport of sailing, if you see what I mean.
This is meant to be the pinnacle of yacht racing. Well, I'm afraid it's moved hellishly sideways. Very, very much sideways. Yeah, fast, and they're sailing. But, you know, there's not a lot of skill for the sailors. It's for the technical guys. That's where the progress is being made. But, you know,
it must be very complicated to helm one of these boats when you've got controls on the wheel. You're trying to do a million things, and it really is beginning to look like a Formula One cockpit in that boat.
Yeah, well, that's what they want. That's what they got. So, you know, if you have these boats, they need all these controls, otherwise they're useless. But I still look, you know, Bruno Trouble, who, after all, was an America's Cup sailor and
French sailing legend.
And a French sailing legend. He who put Louis Vuitton in bed with the America's Cup, he said of this, it's rather like watching a beer can regatta in Beach Cats.
Your opinions always fascinating to get, Bob.
Well, that's not mine, but I agree with it wholeheartedly. I really do. These are pond skaters, they're nothing more than that.
Thanks very much.
Okay, mate.
A six-man America's Cup crew is limited to a total weight of 525 kilos. The less the helmsman and tactician weigh, the heavier each grinder can be.
Oh, it's wag time. Here's Emma Outridge, wife of Artemis Racing helmsman Nathan Outridge. We were discussing earlier on, actually, whether the term wag is one to be used, really, whether it's derogatory or not. But anyway, Emma, you've used your time here in Bermuda to raise thousands of dollars to help a school in Uganda. So it's a great story. Tell us about it.
So I first got involved in CASA. It's a primary school in Uganda. I first went there in 2009 for a six-month volunteering stint with some rather naive dreams of saving the world, but ended up just falling in love with the school and all the people there and everything they were doing. The school was first created for AIDS orphans. HIV/AIDS had really hit the area hard, and it was started by a phenomenal Ugandan couple from the village, Dominic and Rose, who decided to answer the need of all these children that weren't able to go to school because they couldn't afford it. So the school started with 12 children. Today there are 638 children that get an education at this little primary school that's no longer so little. So I went there in 2009, fell in love with the place and what they were doing, and most importantly, how they were doing it. And now I go back every year. I run a sponsorship program that puts children leaving primary school through secondary school and try and do as many fundraisers as I can to try and help the school out where they fall short in funds.
And you've managed to spread the word amongst the America's Cup community.
I have. I grew up as a cup kid. This is currently my eighth America's Cup. So I started in 1988. My dad's been involved with Team New Zealand for years and now SoftBank Team Japan.
So who's your dad? Tell us.
My dad is Ross Blackman. So grew up as a cup kid traveling the world, thought it was normal to bounce between San Diego and New Zealand and all these other fabulous places. And then once I was old enough, I started working on the cup myself, which is how I eventually met my husband, Nathan, working for Louis Vuitton when we were in San Francisco.
We'll talk about Nathan and his sailing in a moment, but I want to know more about this charity because there's a great video out there, which we'll put on our Facebook page as well and share that, all about raising money for a bus.
So when I first went to CASA in 2009, the number one priority on the school's ever-growing priority list was a school bus. I said, well, that's wonderful, but a school bus is $30,000. So in the meantime, we focused on smaller projects. We built dormitories and did other various projects. And it wasn't until I moved to Bermuda that everyone here said, $30,000, that's no problem. We can do that here.
That's about the price of a cucumber in the supermarket here.
Or a pint of milk. So I partnered up with an amazing woman called Rebecca Roberts, who works for Renaissance Re here. And we used their corporate sailing day to get a bunch of the America's Cup sailors on board to try and raise these funds, and in doing so we accidentally raised $40,000, which got the school an incredible bus. So I went out with Rebecca and my brother-in-law Bo Outeridge, who made the film, to deliver the school bus to the village. We all knew it was going to be an unbelievable reception, but we could never have imagined quite what was waiting for us. It was definitely one of the highlights of my entire life, and I think the entire village will forever remember the day that we came in with that school bus.
And tell me about the kids and what a difference that will make for them.
And for them thinking that a bunch of people in a place called Bermuda, which they only know of as the Bermuda Triangle, had all actually pitched in and got together to help their little school in Uganda, gave them a huge sense of pride. And I think for them, you know, they feel like they've been put on the map.
Your husband, Nathan, obviously helmsman on Artemis Racing. They didn't quite make it to the America's Cup match, knocked out by the Kiwis, but they had a pretty good run. What's the atmosphere like at home right now?
Of course, shed a few tears as the boat crossed the finish line in that final race against Team New Zealand, but then that was very quickly replaced by just an incredible, incredible sense of pride.
Is Nathan the sort of athlete that gets really down when he loses and you need to pick him up or leave him alone for a day?
He's phenomenal. He's one of the most positive people I've ever met. He's incredibly unemotional in his sailing. I think years of training to not get fired up and worked up. I remember when we first got together going into the racing in San Francisco, and I asked him if he was excited, and he said no. I said, well, are you nervous? He said no. I said, well, what do you feel? He said, I just need to go out and sail the boat the way I always do. And I think it's this incredible level-headedness that keeps him so calm all the time. And I think a lot of people have commented on that during the racing, that he just never seems to get flustered, even if things aren't going his way. And he's just like that in life. Obviously, it's a disappointment to have not made it through, but I think he also feels an incredible sense of pride, which is now quickly translating into determination for the next one to go again and do the job.
Emma Attridge, thanks very much. Good luck with it.
Thanks so much.
And if you want to know more, you can go to kaaso-uganda.org. That's kaaso-uganda.org. So, Mark, we've come to the end. The great sound is still very azure out there, twinkling, glittering in the sunlight. What is the memory that you'll take away? Because every America's Cup is known for something. What do you think this one will be remembered for?
Well, I think the sheer speed of the boats, the technology throughout, Whether we're going too far down the technology side of things, we'll look back at and see that this was quite a crazy cup as far as the boats go. And whether we're looking at even more craziness in the future, or we start to bring it back to the sailor, we will find out very, very shortly.
Hope you've enjoyed our America's Cup special. Just time to remind you to go to our Facebook page. Lots of photos and videos and race reports from the America's Cup on there. And remember to follow us on Twitter and subscribe to the podcast, because episode 13 will be coming your way in about a month's time. So from me, Alec Wilkinson, it's bye-bye from Bermuda.